This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
From Place to Be Nation, and sure, you don't know who us or two are, but if you're on the Figure Four Online Wrestling Observer Newsletter board, I think you have some idea of who we are from over the years. My name's Greg Diener, and on the other end of the line is Robert Silva, and we voted in the Place to Be Nation Top 100 Greatest WWE Wrestlers of All Time poll that they had going on over the course of the last year. And Robert, it's really weird to call you by your real name, because I'm so used to calling you One Silva, so.
It's just like I'm used to calling you Sky Kid, but that's all right, Greg.
I mean, let's talk about the poll for a second. I mean, we're both from New York, so obviously
right.
New York being the home, technically, it's so weird that they always call WWE New York, but it's actually based in Connecticut. But I guess it's because of the garden.
I guess they called it New York because of Madison Square Garden, of New York being the biggest market, not only in the WWWF and WWF territory, but back then in the 70s and 80s, I believe at one point they were based in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Before they went to Connecticut. So they were never really based in New York, even though Vince McMahon Sr. had offices in New York. Like you said, Connecticut was the main base throughout the 80s till today, and before that, Washington, D.C. But it's called New York because that was the biggest market, not only in the WWF, WWE, Triple WF territory, but the United States as well. That's why they called New York. I mean, if you look at all the other territories, they called Mid-Atlantic the Carolinas, and Georgia, Atlanta, because those were the biggest markets in those territories.
Florida with Eddie Graham. In Tampa.
Florida would be called the Tampa office, right.
Dallas with the Von Erichs.
Right, right, which was Texas with Dallas. Yeah, they always do whatever the biggest market in that territory is what they call it. Like the Southeastern Gulf Coast was always called Pensacola, even though most of the action came out of Alabama.
When we did this top 100 poll, and when I heard about this from Justin on the podcast, on his Place to Be Nation podcast, I thought, well, you know what, this would be fun to do, because I mean, I've been watching wrestling since I was like 4 years old, when watching WWF. So this year's gonna be, I'm gonna turn 34 this year, so it's gonna be 30 years of WWE. So it's like, where did all the time in my life go? I've been watching this since I was 4 years old. But
hey, I stopped watching the current product back in 2002, but I feel you, because I started watching the WWF in 1981. And it's funny, because back then on a Spanish station, WNJU Channel 47, they used to show Florida wrestling on Tuesday nights. So I started watching NWA and WWF around the same time, because I happened to accidentally see it one Tuesday night. I'm like, oh shit. And it was the night that Dusty Rhodes beat Harley Race to win the NWA title back in 1981. So yeah, time has flown. And so many of that time spent going to cards and watching wrestling, trading tapes. Now we get to download them off the internet.
or watch it streaming on the network for $10
a
month.
Right on the network. Yeah, just an hour ago I was watching, they put up a classic Mid-Atlantic. I was watching Mid-Atlantic Wrestling from late 1981.
Yeah, I actually was unsubbed from the network for the last year. I only just got it the other day because they gave me an offer for, like, you get 3 months of WWE Network for 99 cents. So I just took advantage of it. Yeah.
Desperate. They're desperate. I got it. Back. I didn't get it until September of 2016. I didn't subscribe right away. I got it September 2016 when they unearthed that the famous last battle of Atlanta.
Yes.
Once they put that, I was like, yeah, I had to see this.
Yeah, I was right before I unsubbed. I was watching that match, and it was just that. It's unbelievable. You know, I'm a guy who likes, you know, when they I'm always interested when they find old stuff that's never been seen, and then that somehow gets unearthed. Like it's like when they find like a bunch of old 1960s Doctor Who episodes in a cave every like 10 years. Like,
right.
Yeah, so it's like, it's unbelievable that they found that, and of all things, a VHS tape that just said Omni House Show. Because WCW, they didn't know what the heck they had.
Yeah, they had so much good stuff, it's not funny. I'm hoping, and I'm praying, and I asked Bix on Twitter if there was any actual footage. I used to go to the Coliseum cards all the time, but at that time I was living in New Orleans. May 1st, 1987. There was a match, and I remember it was on the cover of either Inside Wrestling or The Wrestler, Randy Savage and Ricky Steamboat, that steel cage match. And for what the aftermath said, this was the best of all the matches they had. And I remember Dave and the Observer back then talked about how, oh, man, this was a sold-out crowd, and the crowd loved it. It was a double juice affair. Always wanted to see that match because that match sounded spectacular. It was May 1st, 1987, Nassau Coliseum. Macho Man against Steamboat, Steamboat being the IC champ at the time.
I hope. Well, if they do another unreleased DVD, they should put that with that Bret Hart Tom McGee.
I know, because recently the WWE came out with a unreleased a DVD, a box set of unreleased matches.
Yeah, I got
that. And I quickly went to see if that match was on there.
But you get the Toxic Turtles, so that's just as good. Nothing like Dwayne Gill in a Michelangelo costume. But let's get to the top 100 list. I used for my list, it was like tough because I knew who the top 15 and 20 were in my head when I first heard the concept. But then it was just trying to rearrange them more. Then it was just like the next is the mid-carders, and then like from 20 to 60, and then those utility guys or people of historical importance at 70 to 100. Right. And it was tough for the last 40 spots, but.
And it was tough because if you look at on the pro wrestling only website, they're showing everybody has got a vote, and it was 340 something people that got at least one vote. So there you go. It was tough breaking it down. And right now, they're down to the top. They're up to the top 25. And from 341 to 125, 19 of my picks have already been wiped off the board, but none of my top 20. It's like the top 20 is easy. The top 20 is easy.
I got a dozen.
I mean, not in the order that you put it in.
No,
but,
no.
But what you sent me – all your 10 picks are in my top 20.
I have like a dozen so far, the list that when we're recording this. I think the first list I had like Killer Khan at 100, and he got in because of the Andre feud. So
right. That was probably the greatest big man feud up until that time in the history of the Federation.
Yeah, it was me, Chris Zeller, and one other guy that voted him the top 100. So Chris, if you're listening, yo, props to you on that 41 vote. I wouldn't have, but I had. I think the highest I have so far that's been revealed is D'Lo Brown at number. I had him at number 70.
Yeah, my highest was Big John Studd. I had Studd in the 30s, and he's already been eliminated.
And I had him at 89. So
yeah,
I had to include John Studd in there because you know.
I had to include Studd, Bundy. And it's funny. Some of the guys at the beginning of the WWF trip, when it was the Triple WF, that did big money, have been eliminated. Guys like Killer Kowalski, Miguel Perez Sr., Antonino Rocca. I had all those guys towards the end of my list. Like you said, historical importance. It's funny, you and I haven't talked about this till today, but my 70 to 100 was also historically important wrestlers and workers from back in the 60s and 70s. Ernie Ladd, Killer Kowalski, those guys were all at the bottom of my ranking.
And he had Bill Watts, I believe.
I had Bill Watts, too.
I never would have thought about Bill Watts.
Because when he had a huge feud with Bruno. They did huge business, and the only reason Bill Watts left the territory, he got into a physical confrontation and was arrested or had with the police. He might have hit a cop Long Island back in the mid-60s, and he was forced to go back to Oklahoma.
Oh, well, I hope it wasn't one of my relatives. I've had a few relatives who were cops in Long Island.
And he never came back to the territory. But from, I think it was 64 to 66, he was huge. He was one of Bruno's first big selling on feuds because he was Bruno's partner. And that was the beginning of a tried and true formula that the WWF did from Bruno to Hogan, where the babyface champion would have that guy, you know, that he could count on,
And
then that guy turns on him and would equal big business. And it happened with Spurious Arion, but the first guy to do it was Cowboy Bill Watts. And, you know, probably the biggest of that was the Macho Man turn on Hogan, and before that, Paul Orndorff turning on Hogan. Those were both huge historically in the WWF. I mean, not today, because everybody turns every other week,
but back then,
when you did it, and you did it right with a top baby face, with the baby face champion, it did huge business.
Let's get to the top 10, our top 10s. I'll let you reveal your number 10.
All right.
I got the list
ready.
Let me
get to it. All right, perfect. I believe my number 10 is Andre the Giant. And when I did my top 10, a lot of guys did their voting, basically did it on ring work. Me, it was a combination of ring work, drawing power, household name.
Yes.
All that into one. Like, if you stop somebody in the street, all 10 of these guys, I believe if you stop a guy in that mid-30s to mid-50s and ask them, oh, name me a wrestler that you followed in the WWF back when you was a kid. One of these 10, and Andre is definitely one name. I mean, Andre, $6 million man, cover of Sports Illustrated. He was just the Princess Bride. There's going to be an HBO documentary coming up on him in April, right?
I'm very excited for that.
Yeah, that looks like cute. I saw one of the clips. It's him and Muhammad Ali in a room. I mean, come on, you in a room with Muhammad Ali. And Andre was a huge draw. Huge draw. Anytime, and Senior was smart. He'd only use Andre two or three times a year. He was Andre's booker. So he would rent Andre out to the other territories, Carolina, Mid-South. Bill Watts loved using Andre. And then he'd bring Andre back. Andre would help Bruno in a feud or help Hogan or help Backlund in a feud that he was having. Or Superfly Snuka, when Snuka was the number one babyface for that two-year run back in the early 80s. He would help them in a feud, and it would be an instant sellout. And Andre was an underrated worker. I mean, people look at the Andre that got body slammed by Hulk Hogan in WrestleMania 3.
That's not Andre.
And Andre was physically, he was past his prime.
Yeah.
But the Andre in the 70s and early 80s, you talk about the feud with Killer Khan, he was tremendous. Those were great brawl. They had a Texas Death Alley match in Madison Square Garden that was off the charts. It's a tremendous match.
Andre, I think, is probably like the one. Even people who don't care for professional wrestling know who Andre the Giant is, because he was it's like Hogan. It's like they were just, if you mention what is professional wrestling, they'll probably say Hogan, Andre the Giant. The first two names will probably pop in their head.
And that goes to being a household name. That goes to that Q rating. These 10 guys that we talk about, guys in their mid-30s to mid-50s, these guys would be one of them. And Andre would be at the top, one of the top of the list. Right alongside Hogan and Bruno when it comes to, I used to watch Bruno. Mike Francesa, who recently retired from after doing almost 30 years on the WFAN radio
yes.
in New York. years ago, a caller asked him, do you watch wrestling? He said, I haven't watched it since I was a kid. I used to love Bruno. It only makes sense. Young Italian-American man watching Bruno, and he's in his mid-60s. He talked about Bruno. Those are the type of guys. Andre's on that level.
It's funny you mentioned Mike Francesa, because I know he mentioned on his show, like, his son's, like, practically, like, begged him to have him order WrestleMania for him. Like, there's, like, a YouTube clip. There's, like, a YouTube anime. They have, like, on the CBS New York YouTube page, they have, like, clips of Mike Francesa moments, like, done with animation.
Okay, okay.
So you have to see it. It's hilarious.
Where did you have Andre? I don't think Andre was in your top 10. Where did you have Andre?
I'm going to look at my list right now. I had him in the top 20. I had him at 19. Yeah, I mean, there was a lot. I mean, there was a lot of guys that I thought had, like, good main event runs that it probably would rank higher. But I really wanted to put Andre in the top 20 because he's so important to the company. Like, I'm putting him like below 20 and below is like an insult to me.
Exactly. I agree with you. And Andre was tough for me to pick at 10 because two of your picks, Angle, Undertaker, they're in my top 20. They almost got the 10th pick. Triple H, Mick Foley, those guys were huge, historically important. I mean, and they almost made, all these guys made my top 20, but I had to put Andre over because when I compare Andre to Triple H and Foley, he was a bigger draw. Undertaker is a perfect example of how Andre used to be booked, where he come in for a short term with some huge business. They bring him back for between the Royal Rumble and WrestleMania. That's basically how Vince Sr. used to book Andre. He'd bring him in for a 2-3 month period at a time and pop the houses and then get rid of him, send him somewhere else. Well, Undertaker would go home, but Undertaker would go because you didn't need him all year. And if you kept Undertaker today too long in the last 10 years, like Andre back then, the gimmick would get burnt out.
I'm going to reveal my number 10. You know, when you think about this is my number 10, you think, oh my God, that's number 10. I guess everyone else must be, this is going to be some top 10 of yours. My top 10, my number 10 was The Rock.
And you know what? Of your top 10, why he's that low, I have the biggest problem with your top 10, why he's that low. I mean, Rock, international superstar.
Yeah.
Forget what he's done in the movies.
No.
What he did. Him and Stone Cold in 1997 when Bret Hart went to WCW. And by the way, real quick, so we could just do this discussion on The Rock. Rock was my number 4. So
okay.
We don't have to go back twice. Rock was my 4th.
Okay.
He's your 10th, my 4th. Rock in 1997, after Bret Hart left the whole Montreal screw job and with the WCW, the WWF was in, turmoil.
Oh, God.
Basically, it was a two-man promotion. If you watch Raw November 1997 to March 1998, basically, it was more than 2 men. It was
Austin.
Triple H was still unproven. Stone Cold, who was hurt, he was only coming on Raw. He wasn't wrestling in the house shows. Undertaker, Rock, that's it. Everybody else was mid-card level at best. I went to the house shows back then, and Austin wasn't wrestling. Austin wasn't wrestling because his neck was still injured, right?
Yeah.
After the Royal Rumble, Shawn Michaels didn't wrestle to WrestleMania because he hurt his back in that match against The Undertaker.
Yeah.
Undertaker wasn't wrestling because he was doing a fake injury that he got at the hands of
Kane.
What was Triple H and Kane, right. So basically, it was The Rock carrying things from that moment on. And then when Stone Cold got hurt again and re-injured his neck for the entire year 2000, Rock single-handedly carried that promotion. Not too many wrestlers in the history of the Triple WF are on that level. You Hogan, of course, Stone Cold, Bruno, Pedro Morales. Those, and at one time, Jimmy Snuka, but I can't even challenge Jimmy Snuka because when he was the number one face, half the time he was in drug rehab.
Yeah.
I'm talking about for a whole year. In 2000, The Rock carried the WWF on his shoulders, and they, if I'm not mistaken, had their biggest profit year ever in 2000 when when Austin was on the sidelines, couldn't wrestle, and The Rock was electrifying everybody week in and week out on SmackDown and Raw with his promos. And he was a tremendous worker, and he would do the job if he had to put the next guy over, because he knew what didn't hurt him, because he had all the charisma in the world. The single most charismatic wrestler in the history of professional wrestling is The Rock, because he could just stand there, do the eyebrow, and everybody would just eat it up. But he was more than that. He was one of the greatest promos of all time. I mean, week in and week out, he was great. He'd come in a designer shirt, and you try to get into a debate with him, whoever was doing the promo, whether it was Triple H, what's the Giants thing, the Big Show, those guys, and he would make them stumble. Only other guy I ever saw do that was Roddy Piper.
It's amazing, because when The Rock first came in, it was the Survivor Series in 96.
Oh, he was horrible. They really didn't know what to do with him.
No, they didn't. I mean, you can even tell. It's like that. You could tell he had the talent, but the character was not good. And then I think he got...
They made him a white meat babyface.
And they gave him the Intercontinental title, and he had, I guess... Who did he wrestle? Oh, he wrestled Rikishi as the Sultan at WrestleMania that year, which was...
Yeah, which was horrible.
No,
it was horrible. They put the IC title on him too fast, and they was pushing him down the fans' throats, and anybody that's been following wrestling for more than 5 years know that if you try to shove a babyface down hardcore wrestling fans' throats, they're going to shit all over the product. It wasn't until Rock in late 1997... joined the Nation of Domination, where he was allowed to speak, where natural charisma began to shine. Go ahead.
The heel promo he cuts, like, right after he turns, is perhaps, like, one of my favorite promos ever.
And it was the first, and that same promo was the first time I even knew that Rock could talk. Because up until that time, Rocky Maivia, I thought he was a stumbling idiot. Because when he did talk, he was like, oh, shucks. I'm going to do my best.
And then,
that night, he went from being Tim Horner to Ric Flair.
Yeah. And then he has the great promo, the great program at with Austin, with Austin throwing the belt over the
and
the
that right there, you know, it, 99 times out of 100, a heel does that. I mean, a babyface does that to a heel. The heel's done. I'm not giving you the belt. It's worthless to me. It goes in the ocean. No, the facial expressions that Rock did while he's watching this on video put him even more over. I can't stand the bastard, but I got to give Russo credit. Late night, him and McMahon teased the hell out of wrestling fans who wanted Rock to turn good. And it looked like Rock, who was fighting McMahon and Shane McMahon, looked like he was about to be a babyface. Then the Survivor Series screw job where they screw Mick Foley and The Rock becomes the corporate champion. The fans go ape shit. They're pissed. That was great. I mean, that was great. That made Rock even a bigger star. And then finally, when he turned in the spring of 99, it was all his from then on.
It was magic. And I think that whole thing at the 98 Survivor Series, that is like Russo's booking 99% of the time makes no sense. But this was the 1% of the time where it actually did make sense. Because he never really officially turned face. It was just the crowd wanted him to be a face.
The crowd, we wanted him to turn face. We wanted him. And it looked week to week. It was like, oh my God, this guy is... This is the man right now. Yes, yes. And pulled the rug out from under us, but we still wanted The Rock to turn. And when he finally did, there was no turning back.
Oh, no. The program he has with Foley until he gets to Austin at WrestleMania is so great. I will watch, whenever I'm bored, I will watch the empty arena match between him and Foley.
Because Rock puts all of his entire repertoire is on the line, is right there. He gives it to you during that empty arena match because he shows how great of a worker he is. He puts the headset on and he's announcing the ass kicking he's given Foley. I mean, what a tremendous, I love that match. And I love, and Foley barely missed my top 10. He's in my top 15. But the way he made The Rock and Triple H into superstars, I don't think you've ever seen another wrestler in the history or work in the history of the WWF, WWE, Triple WF, put two people over as big as those guys became, like Mick Foley did.
Rock is always, he'll always be like this, and he's doing it now in the movies. Like, I watched Jumanji, like, last month, and he was fantastic in it. I enjoyed the hell out of that movie.
Hey, Central Intelligence is, and you know, he's been paired up with Kevin Hart, and the chemistry those two guys have is phenomenal. Yeah. Kevin Hart is the number one comedian on the planet right now. Every time he's in a movie, it's the box office. Central Intelligence, it was more about The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, comedic timing as Kevin Hart. It's like Kevin Hart was feeding off The Rock, which is hard to do. That's how great this guy is.
Yeah.
He's just phenomenal.
I think, you know, you talked about 2000. That's arguably, I think, his best year.
Well, it is his best year. Also, it's the most profitable year in the history of professional wrestling for any company.
Yeah.
And that's The Rock. There's no Stone Cold. Stone Cold shows up one time in 2000 where he's the guest referee at SummerSlam. That's it.
Yeah, and he shows up, I guess, one time. He smashes
the DS puts bus. McMahon over Triple H to win the title. Yeah. Well, other than that, it's Stone Cold
show. It's
his show. I mean, it's Rock's show because Stone Cold is unable. He had that career-threatening neck injury.
I mean, he put on some fantastic. He has that Iron Man match with Triple H.
Right.
He has the one match at Fully Loaded with He Who Shall Not Be Named.
That was a great match.
Yeah, yeah. It was. Yeah. Let me try to. He had. We'll get to it with Angle, but he has the match where Angle wins the title at No Mercy. 2001.
And Rock made Angle.
He did.
Rock, and when Angle first came on, they tried to shove him down our throats as a white meat baby face. With the All-American gold. Wrestling fans were past that, you won a gold medal. Automatically, you're a baby face. You're white meat baby face. But they were smart. They figured it out early. They had Scott Backlund as his manager. He had a feud with Taz. It wasn't working. When he started first with the feuding with The Rock, and then when he did that whole, and they dropped the ball on this, the whole Triple H Stephanie love triangle, they should have took that to the, when he tongue kissed her in the back after she got hurt, the crowd went crazy. We were ready to see Stephanie turn on Triple H, but Triple H, because his ego, that's why he'll never make my top 10, got in the way and was like, no. Let's put a kibosh to this. So they ended it right there, and you never saw her with Angle again as far as that threesome. But that was tremendous.
Yeah.
All because and The Rock with Angle, he put Angle over.
Yeah, made him look like $1 million, and then.
And he was already $1 million. He made him look like $2 million. And Angle, who was probably the most naturally talented professional wrestler to come right away, it was no turnaround. Because Angle was like Rock. He could lose, and it would not do anything to his star power because he's that good.
Yes. SummerSlam 02, Brock Lesnar gives him the rub and.
Who did he wrestle SummerSlam? No, SummerSlam 2001 was
Booker
Angle and it was Booker T because it was Angle and Austin in SummerSlam 2001. SummerSlam 2001 and SummerSlam 2002 were two spectacular pay per views. Those were phenomenal, and the match with Lesnar was great. He made Lesnar a superstar because he put Lesnar over, and also the build to that because this was right at when I stopped watching. The product. The build to that match was phenomenal because they showed both guys training, both guys taking this as a sporting event. He puts Lesnar over, and then Triple H comes out a week or two later and pronounces that he's another world champion, and that turned the TV off for good. All right, then go to your number nine.
All right, so let's go to Kurt Angle, who is my number nine.
Perfect segue. Yeah. Go ahead.
Kurt Angle, number nine, and it's amazing how much of a natural Kurt Angle was going from Olympic gold medalist amateur wrestler to professional wrestler, and it's just great worker, and he was always entertaining. Some of the comedy he does, I think 2000, 2001, is, I think, some of the best comedy in the history of the company.
Without a doubt. And no need any help, and rarely with any help from The Rock, Austin, or Triple H, who were also great comedic figures.
I mean, I love 2000 when he becomes the European and Intercontinental champions. He's like, I made history. I became the first European and Intercontinental champion at the same time. Well, actually, it was D'Lo Brown, but he doesn't count.
Right.
And what I liked about his character is he's being this aw shucks baby face while being a heel and being like, oh, why are you all booing me?
Yeah.
and he's just being an ass, and it's like he doesn't realize he's an ass. That's what I absolutely love. And it's like it fit.
And what I love, and you went to the house shows back then like I did, whether it was the Nassau Coliseum, the Meadowlands, or Madison Square Garden, when he came out to his music, the fans in unison, you suck. You suck. And then the look on his face when the fans would say that was priceless.
My favorite moments is him with the milk truck.
That was hilarious. That was great. That was great because they had turned it. They fucked up the invasion angle.
But
the best thing about the invasion angle was the chemistry while these two were feuding with Angle and Austin. It was great. And, you know, he had just lost the title to Angle on the Raw that you're talking about. And he's Austin celebrating the ring with Stephanie and the whole alliance crew, and here comes Kurt Angle with the milk truck, and he sprays them with milk.
The all-time great line, one of my all-time great JR liners is from that moment where he sprays Stephanie and JR says, the billion-dollar princess is now a Dairy Queen.
Yeah, that was great.
And then he just chugs the milk bottle.
So he takes a carton of milk and chunks it down real quick, which is dangerous. You could choke to death like that. But he chunks it down like how Stone Cold chunked down the beer.
And the best part is, I loved how it was like a callback to when Austin had the beer truck.
That's what it was. You're right.
Angle gets the most not like it fit with his character.
And he had spectacular matches with the man who killed his wife and child and killed himself.
Yes.
He had spectacular matches with Brock Lesnar. I mean, was Lesnar the one? Was it the match where one of those guys did a moonsault off the top of the cage?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Or was it the Jushin Liger move?
Yeah, I think that was. I think that was again. Oh God. Maybe. Yeah, it was. It was against the match, I think, but he who shall not be named. It was, I think, a SmackDown, I think.
But Lesnar and Kurt Angle had a match where one of them did the what you call it? The Shooting Star Press. I was like, God damn. Angle forced you to come up with where we would just put your working shoes on. And Angle working with Lesnar made Lesnar a better worker. And there's always there's always the legend that he beat the shit out of Lesnar in a shoot wrestling match in the back.
Oh, man, I would have paid to see that.
I think Shelton Benjamin broke it up or something. But, yeah, they always talk about that. And then when they brought up to Dave, they was like, you can't really take that seriously. They're in their flip-flops. They're not trying to get hurt.
Sure, Dave, sure. I got to say, I mean, if you talk about longevity, like, Angle's run is basically 2000 to 2006, but I think he had such a great promo ability, great work rate, great matches, that it's like...
Well, look, your number 10 was The Rock, and Rock's run was basically 1997 to 2003, because after that he left and he came back for a couple of a record-breaking match with Cena, but still, his run was a six-year run as well.
Yeah. But I've been watching that on the network. When I just got back, they have the WWE 24 series, and they had the one on Angle when he got inducted to the Hall of Fame, and I watched that. It was pretty good. I mean, it was a really good in-depth piece, and it's probably like one of my like favorite things, and it's pretty good. I mean, they go throughout his history, the struggles he had with drug addiction. They even interviewed Dixie Carter, for God's sakes.
Wow.
Yeah, they did.
Now I gotta check this out. Yeah,
it's very good. So, I mean,
I gotta give Angle all the credit in the world. He was fired. Now, he was fired before the man that we will not talk about did what he did. So, I mean, that's how serious his problems were with drugs and painkillers. McMahon didn't want another death on his watch. Now, I mean, while he was right to do what he did, he wasn't looking at somebody else. But after that, he turned his life around. And
definitely.
You know, 10 years ago, the odds were he was going to be the next tragedy in wrestling. It never happened.
Yeah, and thank God he's still with us.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
So now let's go to your number nine. And I guess
my
this
number nine is your, what do you have Shawn Michaels at?
Shawn is
six, right?
Six,
your
yes.
Number six.
Yes.
All right, my number nine is your number six. Shawn Michaels, never liked Shawn Michaels. He never, the only time he ever lost title in the ring puss to Stone Cold because Undertaker threatened to fuck him up? I mean, why, when he came back in 2002, McMahon never put the strap on him because he didn't want to deal with that issue. But pound for pound, among all the workers in the history of the WWF, Triple WF, WWE, he's the single greatest worker in the history of the Federation. I cannot argue that. He was a phenomenal worker. I mean, tremendous with his tag team with the Rockers. I mean, if you want to look at his run from 1988 to when he first had to leave in 1998, a 10-year run, he had, if you list the top 100 matches, he probably was at 50 of them in the WWF alone. He was a tremendous worker. That cage match, that the first Hell in a Cell with Kane, is, in my opinion, still the greatest. Now, with Undertaker, it's still, in my opinion, the greatest Hell in a Cell match. I mean, he bled buckets. And he made Undertaker, who up until that point was not considered a good worker. He was considered by many, including David Stiff, who just had a great, great gimmick. He bumped the hell out of that match. He bled buckets. That match stands the test of time. I can watch that match any day of the week. A great, great, great match. All because of Shawn Michaels. He was great in that match.
And that match, I think, has the last great babyface announcer Vince moment before he becomes the Mr. McMahon character.
Right, right. Before Kane he becomes debut, Mr. McMahon. Right,
where he goes,
right,
that's right. Gotta be Kane! That's like something that's ingrained in your head. It's been ingrained in my head for 20 years. That's gotta be Kane.
And you have the WrestleMania 10, a ladder match with Razor Ramon, which was innovative and ahead of its time. And you've had a million ladder matches since. That was the most important because it began that trend of the ladder. I mean, it's been top. I mean, the fucking Hardy Boys have had a lot of ladder matches better than that. But that match set a trend, and it was just sensational. We never saw anything like that.
No.
In 1992, when Bret Hart first won the WWF World title from Ric Flair, his first major pay-per-view, Survivor Series of 1992, the main event was against Shawn Michaels. One of the best matches of the 90s that no one talks about.
No.
A great match, the best match the two of them ever had. That was a spectacular match.
I remember when that match was happening, and because when I was 8, I just thought, this is just kind of crazy, because when you really think about it, 18 months ago, these guys were tag team wrestlers, and now they're...
They were both baby faces, right.
And now they're in the main event, they're holding the two most important, the two biggest titles at the time in the company, and nobody remembers this, but a couple months earlier, they had like a television match on primetime, which was the first ladder match ever.
That was a very good match. Yes, yes.
No, that was on primetime, and I have that.
Right.
It's actually I don't think it's been on any of the DVD comps, but there was a VHS tape that was put out for retail in the mid '90s called WWF's Most Unusual Matches, and it's somewhere in my basement. But it has that match on there. And it also
that was a great match. And yes. Bret Hart introduced that into the WWF because that was a staple of Stampede Wrestling.
Yes. Because I think he had tried
To piggyback on your point about how 18 months prior they were both in babyface tag team. That match is historically important. The Survivor Series 1992 main event, Bret Hart versus Shawn Michaels, because it showed the WWF going away from the steroid era, no longer is it Hulkamania era, and going into that Bret Hart era, where it will be Bret Hart 1A and Shawn Michaels 1B.
Yes.
That was the beginning of the era. I mean, he went away from it when he tried to push Lex Luger. But basically, that Survivor Series showed that they were going to be smaller. They weren't going to try. And of course, he had no choice. He was about to be on trial for steroid distribution.
And 93, he has it's on that tape too. Nobody ever talks about it. He had like some good matches on those Manhattan Center Raws with Hacksaw Jim Duggan.
They even had a lumberjack match that was off the charts.
Is on the tape.
Yes.
And the best part is this was during his feud with Mr. Perfect, where they have the fight in the outside the Manhattan Center.
Right. That was great. Yeah, yeah.
And the best part.
And also.
So Sean goes in the match. He's on crutches. He's like, oh, I'm not going to. Like, oh, I can't fight him on crutches. And then Perfect just comes out. He takes the crutches off, and he's in the ring, and it's, like, revealed, like, he's not really hurt at all. And my favorite moment is Bobby Heenan yelling, it's a miracle! It's a miracle!
And it would be a foreshadowing of things to come, because he would pull those crutches out again a couple of years later. I lost my smile! But during that, I saw the three best matches I ever saw on Raw, I went to at the Manhattan Center. There was the Bret Hart 1-2-3 Kid match. We'll talk about it when we talk about Bret Hart. That was a sensational match. His two matches with Marty Jannetty in the Manhattan Center, they were great match. Great matches. I mean, spectacular matches.
The May 17th Raw, which is the same show the Kid upsets Razor, where Marty comes from the crowd, and then they have the match. That is an underrated match when I think of.
And then the match in July, the same Raw taping where Jerry Lawler goes into the crowd and gets in Stu Hart's face.
Yes,
and he's lucky Stu Hart didn't grab him because it would have been the end of the King. But that same taping, Marty Jannetty and Shawn Michaels had an almost 5-star classic. That was even better than the May 17th match. I was at both those shows. The crowd went crazy. And I could have sworn Jannetty was going to win that title a second time.
94, they have Shawn and Diesel. They have a phenomenal match with 1-2-3 Kid and Razor Ramon on the Action Zone.
That was also on a WWF videotape. It was on a WWF videotape. I didn't see the Action Zone. I saw it on a videotape a year later.
Yeah, it was
on a Coliseum videotape.
It was the second episode of the Action, because I remember they were really trying to push the Action Zone as like, because I guess it was like this was the time where.
Action Zone took the place of Challenge?
It took the place of All American. It kind of did
replace, All American, right.
It
kind of
did
right,
replace
right, right.
Challenge in the WWF canon, but I think it was also because they really were. I think because this is Vince. He was
right,
probably,
right. Because All American used to be on noon on USA, and then Action Zone was on noon at USA. Yeah. Right on Sunday.
Yeah. So this
right.
was probably like a Vince thing where he was getting pissed because the NFL on Fox was starting, and that was hurting like the syndicated airings of Challenge. So like I remember like on like Raw when they were like plugging the Action Zone, they'd like take pot shots at NFL.
Right. That's what? Right, because there was no Challenge was no longer shown on Channel 5 because they were showing NFL on Fox, the pregame show, right?
Yeah, because this was when like Uncle Rupert bought the NFC rights from CBS for like a gajillion dollars. So
yeah, it was 1994, which made the Fox Network.
Yeah.
Up until that point, Fox Network was looked at as BET primetime, basically. They had a bunch of black shows.
And The Simpsons.
And The Simpsons. Right. You had Rock and Living Color, True Colors. These were all black shows. And The Simpsons. When they bought the rights to the NFC, and they got the rights to the NFC, and they bought them in 94, that made, to this day, that turned the Fox Network around and made it a true network.
And Sean, we have the rematch for Frazier at SummerSlam 95.
Which was the best match of a dismal year. 1995 was an abysmal year for the WWF. I know because I watched every pay per view, and I recorded every Action Zone and Superstars and Raw. It was a very bad year for the WWF, both financially and creativity, work rate.
Yeah.
And there was also that year another great match. Was the match where he collapsed against Owen Hart, and the crowd goes, and I watched. They better send the doctor in.
And oh, I forgot. Royal Rumble '95. He went. It's a lackluster
Rumble.
With the one foot.
Yes.
But that is one of the most memorable moments in the history of the Royal Rumble, where it's,
yes,
well, you
without
see,
a doubt.
Where he's, where Bulldog's music plays, and then he comes back, and then they show the replay, and you see Vince, 1 foot! And it's just him.
It's gotta be both feet! Yeah.
Which did they ever, like, say it was supposed to be 2 feet that have to hit the floor, or was that the first time?
I think that was either, I don't know if that was creative booking by Pat Patterson, or Shawn was supposed to win the Royal Rumble, and he made a mistake, and so they improvised. I'm not sure. But however it was, it made sense. You know, wrestling fans hate to be insulted, but that finish made sense. You could justify it.
Yeah. And it led to, like, I think one of my favorite moments where Jerry Lawler did the same trick.
Oh,
in the middle.
Then Bret Hart punched him out.
he stepped on his foot. And then he got eliminated.
But did he punch him too? Did he punch him too after he stepped on his foot?
He probably did. It's been like 20 years since I've seen it. But
yes.
And then he wins the title from Bret at WrestleMania, and then
which was a disappointing match in my opinion. I thought that match should have been one of the matches of the decade. It was a good match. But there was something missing. I don't know if Bret's heart was in it because he was about to take a sabbatical to film that cowboy show that
Lonesome Dove.
Lonesome Dove. And the fact that he had to give the belt to Shawn Michaels, who up at that time he didn't like. I don't think Bret's heart was in that match. And talk about a double a tendre. Bret's heart was in the match.
I think I like the match, but I think what's disappointing about it is it's one fall for 60 minutes when it's an Iron Man match. I think if you would have had, let's say, one of the guys gets the first fall early, and then you have, like, the drama of one of the guys trying to hold that one fall, tie it up the whole match, I think that would have made a more compelling story.
And to the WWF / WWE's credit, since that match, the Iron matches that they had since then have been better because they have gone to that concept that you just described.
Yeah. He has, I think the following month, he has in Diesel's, I guess, last pay-per-view match, Good Friends, Better Enemies, where...
Is that the match with
Mad Dog?
Bashan's,
foot?
Mad Dog's foot?
Yes!
Diesel had tremendous matches with both Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. That was it. He didn't have a good match with anybody else. In his entire career, Kevin Nash's best matches were either Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels. And the WWF made a mistake back in 96. They should have did whatever they could to keep Kevin Nash, Diesel, because he had turned it into a phenomenal heel. He was a great heel when he left the WWF with his feud, when his feud with Shawn Michaels, he had turned into a great heel, and they could have capitalized on that. They could have let Razor Ramon go. His time had passed. But Diesel had developed into a phenomenal heel.
Oh, he was probably like, I think, the first, I guess, cool heel. Like, he was like a heel you could actually buy liking.
No, but the fans hated him.
Yeah.
In early 96, when he turned
Shawn. They did.
He had tremendous heat. I mean, he was fun. And the Undertaker match was not that good at WrestleMania because his heart wasn't in it, because he knew he was leaving for bigger and better things. But had they had re-signed him, I can imagine the feud with Shawn Michaels continuing throughout 96. That would have been golden at the box office.
Yeah, whatever.
Because one of the things that keeps me from putting Shawn higher, he's number 9 basically on work rate and promo. As a draw, he dropped the ball several times as a WWF champion. In 1996, they went through one. In 95 and 96, he's the number 1 face in the company. Well, actually, in 95, Diesel was the number 1 face. In 96, Shawn Michaels was the number 1 face. Both their reigns, Diesel and Shawn Michaels, did horribly at the box office. I was able to get tickets to Madison Square Garden while Shawn Michaels and Diesel were world champions. The day of the matches. That never happened before. That happened. The Garden was always historically 15,000 or more people coming to the arena. doing 95 and 96 when Diesel and Shawn Michaels were world champions, you could go to the Garden the day of the show and get good seats. Not bad, good seats. And it continued not till Stone Cold became Stone Cold in 97 did business turn around.
Okay, folks, because this went so long, longer than I expected, this will be divided up into four parts here on Place to Be Nation, so stay tuned when me and Robert give part two of our top 10 coming in the very near future. Till then, catch you later.